The following program is paid for by Little John Financial Services. The opinions and views expressed may not reflect those of Brook Communications, its affiliates, or its employees.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4. Every weekday, News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN brings you local information at 4 o'clock. Now presented by Little John Financial Services. It's David Little John with True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
All right, gang, you know what time it is. It's time for the True Wealth Radio Show on this, the greatest Tuesday you've had all week. I am your host, Dave Littlejohn.
And
back.
Yes.
In studio with
Matt Dixon. All hey, right. I warmed the chair up for you.
Thank you.
Yes.
And thank you for holding down the fort.
You're welcome.
Those of you that are regular listeners, you know, it's been a stretch since I've been here. Had an opportunity with a senior graduating from high school this year to take kind of a big trip. So we made it across the pond and saw some of Europe. There were some friends that were made on exchange. And so we connected with a couple of families. And it was a great trip, but it is also great to be back home.
Is the coffee as good as everyone says?
Yeah. I mean, there was some good coffee.
Nice.
I didn't drink a ton of it. Believe
really?
It or not, I'm not a big coffee drinker. And then you're probably thinking to yourself, seriously? Because like I drink coffee on the regular.
Right.
But to me, if I didn't have coffee, I would just drink whatever else I needed to. It's almost more like a comfort thing that I do. I'm not addicted to the caffeine or any of that. Like I don't notice it. My like literally my genetic profile is like, yeah, caffeine doesn't do it.
So you don't get the caffeine headaches if you skip a cup of coffee?
No. Nor do I get a big pick me up if I drink caffeine. It's kind of a relatively low impact. It's not zero impact, but it's relatively low impact.
Gotcha. Well, were the pastries good? What was the best part? Like the best thing you had that was maybe food or drink?
So there really are some lights out pastries. Some of the best stuff that I had, we got to go to France, and there was some stuff. You really do go to like the local bakery, and first thing in the morning you get stuff. There were some fruit tarts that were just lights out.
Mm-hmm.
There were just a lot of the breads in general. They're just, when it's really fresh,
right,
it's just good.
Yeah.
You know, it's the texture's great. The flavor's great. It is interesting. They don't use butter there.
Mm-hmm.
That's a very American thing, is to put butter on bread. They're just, in fact, they'll bring bread to the table and like nothing. Just like,
right,
it's just bread. Like, huh. With the French fries too? Like, with some carbs, are there carbs?
Yeah.
That's what they do.
Had you not gone on this trip, it probably would have been one of those things, don't you think, where you would have looked back on it and been like, man, I really, really wish that that was something I would have done.
So,
you know what I mean?
For like, my family, yes. Right? I think for me personally, everybody's bucket list is sort of unique to them.
Sure.
But I have my personal list of things that I really get excited about for just me, but it's a different list when I'm wearing my dad hat and my husband hat, saying, would I have really regretted it for the family? Probably. I'm really glad that we had this moment in time where my kids are of the right age, that they're going to remember it, and they're still living at home, and we can still do it. Before they started families of their own and things started to shift.
Right, so, and you've got one kid who's really grown up quick, right? And it's like,
I have three daughters that are growing up quick, but one who is starting college, and that is the official starting to exit the nest potentially.
Right, you're running out of time to be able to do this stuff.
You know, there are just seasons in life, and this is one of them where either we did it or that season passes, and it's something that you wish you would have done, which, you know, there are plenty of things in my life that I look back on and go, I wish I would have.
What was one of those almost moments where you almost did it, but you like were a little gun shy or something, and you like it's your number one regret to this day? You're like, I really wish I could go back and seize that moment or seize that opportunity.
Ooh, that's a toughie. I'll tell you one that it doesn't really impact my life at all, but I could tell you like a mistake that I made. One of the first things that come up, like I wish I could have redone it, was it was an athletic event. I was at a state race. I was running in the 110 meter hurdles.
Yeah.
And I got out with probably the greatest start of my career at the state finals. And I was so ahead of myself that I was advancing on the hurdles out of sync with my steps. I was coming up on them too fast. And about the fourth hurdle, I went down.
Ooh.
And so I ended up finishing last in that race. But when I went over the fourth hurdle, I had already put a substantial gap in front of me and every other competitor. Mm-hmm. Like I was winning that race and it would have been great. You know, it's one of those things where I go, yeah, that's a toughie. Did it really impact anything in my life? No, it didn't make me any more or less talented at the end of the day. Nobody really looks at the leaderboard and sees the name and thinks much of it. And even if they knew a name, they wouldn't recognize me with it. So it's okay. But it was a meaningful point in life where I'm like, oh, that's when I wish I could head back.
Yeah.
So I don't know. And then probably sometimes I had some other travel where I wish I would have been maybe just braver, you know, done things that were slightly braver.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Try something new.
And I don't have a lot of – I try not to live life with the idea that look in the rearview mirror and be full of regrets.
Right.
But I also know that I've been very good at deferring gratification. There were some times when, you know, people went out and had a great time and I was always the financially responsible one. I don't really regret that, but I know that I traded one opportunity for another.
Right. So. There's none of them you wish – yeah. Okay, that's fair.
Yeah. So that's a lot of it. Stuff that you thought was important at one point, now you realize it's not. Like, I don't care how loud my car stereo is anymore. But there was a season I thought it was a big deal. And now I look back and go, you're an idiot.
Yeah. You're going to find this one funny. I think my biggest regret was there was a mule deer hunt I could have gone on in Washington. I had a friend who had private property. The tag was like $500 for an out-of-state thing. And I'm like, it was the same thing. I was like, $500. And at the time, it was a lot of money. And I'm like, sure. I'll just go another year. Well, they ended up selling the farm and never got to go on that hunt. I'm like, in retrospect, that's one I wish I could take back, where it's like, I should have just gone on the hunt.
Yes.
But you can't bring that one back.
There are some experiences, too, where I can think specifically about, I'm glad I did do that thing.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I went on a scuba diving trip and got to go to Thailand and go scuba diving.
That's cool.
And I went with the group and with the instructor, it was just me and the instructor that ended up doing a cave dive. And it was really wild to go into a cave and you know, I realized that can be very dangerous, by the way. So it was somebody had already been in there. There were lines that we could follow. We had they call them torches, right? They're big flashlights.
Yeah.
But I literally went into a network of caves, came up and surfaced inside the cave, and then tied off our gear and walked around in an internal network of caves.
That's pretty cool.
And then went back, put the gear back on, and went back out. And we missed a big thunderstorm. The rest of the party that was diving ended up on they were on the boat in the rainstorm. And because we were walking around in there, we had about an extra 15 minutes. We missed the storm. Heard big booms, didn't know what it was, but turns out it was the thunder, and we could hear it in the caves inside of this sort of cliff side that we were hiking within. It was really, really something. And so I'm just glad I did it because it's such a unique experience.
Right.
You know, how many people can say that they did a cave dive in, you know, the tropical waters and saw things that nobody else got to see? So that was cool.
Yeah, I mean, and I think this is all very, very relevant today to the show today, because there's a ton of different things that you can probably point to over the course of someone's life where they almost did something and then they didn't do it and it ended up costing them in a huge way. I remember I had a family member right when Bitcoin first came out, and they're like, I really want to put $100 in this. And you can only imagine like what that could have done had they just actually done it, right?
I remember when Bitcoin was like $2, and I didn't even know what it was or how to get it. And I even remember thinking the novelty of maybe pick some up. I'm like, I don't even know how.
Yeah.
And so that's the wild part about it, is it's just such a, you know, today you look at it and go, wow, I mean, that's whatever, you know, fluctuating between $70,000 and $115,000 in value depending on what day you happen to see it.
It
seems to be shifting. That's not the subject of today, but fascinating.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, there does seem to be do you make the right trade? You know, I'm looking at some of the notes here, and you have on here, what's the price of almost?
Yeah.
And I had a mentor that used to use the phrase good trade all the time. Like, was it a good trade or not? But it's funny because in an investment show, you immediately think about trading, like trading stocks or
sure.
something like that. But he wasn't just talking about that. He was talking about, well, I did this thing in life. He's like, well, that was a good trade of my time and resources for that experience. And mm-hmm. he used to talk about it that way. And I thought, what a fascinating way to view the world, because ultimately it's pretty accurate. You do one thing or another. You're trading one experience for another.
Well, and how many times have you seen someone just not do something even though they knew it was a good idea? Those are the really, really tough ones to watch, right? Like, oh, you know, I got a house that I could refinance at a much lower rate. And it's like, well, I'll get to it one day, and then you never do or something. And it's like, well, how much did that cost you over your lifetime? Yeah. Or, you know, just there's a lot of those little things where it's like, I know I should do it, but you never get to it. Life insurance can be that way, right? Like, oh, I need to get a life insurance policy. I'll get to it one day. And then you get hit by a school bus and your poor wife is crying like, oh, there, you know, there should have been a policy. Should have just signed it, but you didn't do it.
That's real.
Yeah.
There are things that, you know, you just should have done. There are things that, and I think it's really important that we consider there are windows of opportunity and they're not open forever. When you said that, what first came to mind too is how many times have we had to tell a client, you should spend some money?
Oh, all the time.
Right? Surprising that we have to have that conversation. You think as advisors, we're always saying, hey, you know, save to make sure it lasts and, you know, be good stewards to any other. Yeah, we say those things, but there are points at which you say, you realize that your trajectory is that you're going to leave more behind than you're going to utilize.
You actually spent. Yeah.
And so there, the cost of almost can also be commingled with the idea of maximizing utility value.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So I almost did this. Did I maximize the value? I think this is something that is fun, because I'm looking forward to talking more about this. Look at the clock. Why don't we do this? As we get into this, if you're interested, I want you to stick around with us, because you may be doing some math in your mind already saying like, well, should I be doing this or not? And we're going to try to break that apart and maybe help with it. Maybe you're making some of those decisions right
sure.
now. Okay, so stick with us. We're going to cover more. We'll be right back. I'm Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
Yeah, True Wealth on News Radio 92.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
Yeah, well, not just in the middle, because it doesn't work specifically on, it's not like one category for everything. Like, you may have a category where you're in the middle here, but you're on an extreme somewhere else.
Yeah.
Anyway, welcome back to the True Wealth Show. If you're just tuning in, Dave Littlejohn here with
Matt Dixon.
And today it's the cost of almost.
Mm-hmm.
Right? The cost of almost, what causes almost, the price of almost, what do we want to call it? But this idea that sometimes there are decisions that we don't make that we look back on with regret.
Mm-hmm.
Other times there may be decisions that we make without thinking, and then we look back on it with regret because the thing that we did or the thing that we didn't do.
Right.
And so financially, a lot of that stuff happens. And so how can we, all of you guys listening, even Matt and myself included here, how can we make better decisions? I think some of it's break it apart and understand how you're making the decisions in the first place. So I got a question for you, Matt.
Yeah.
What is... Can you think of a financial decision, like a purchase that you wish you would have made and didn't?
I can tell you one I almost made and I'm glad I didn't.
Okay, that I like this.
I was engaged before I met my wife, and I was going to get married. And had I done that, that probably would have been the worst decision I ever made. And in retrospect, I didn't see it. Because, I mean, you got to think, like, we've talked about this on the show before. Divorces are expensive, like, bad relationships expensive.
Yeah.
Like, if you're not equally yoked on your finances or you're not, like, in sync, stuff, like, if your
Things
personal
break.
Life, yeah, if your personal life is just in shambles, it's really hard to care about the the numbers and cents behind what you're doing.
Yeah, the costs are profound when relationships are damaged. I mean, there's a health cost to it. There's a financial cost to it. Here's something that's interesting. I don't have great statistics available because we didn't pull these, but I can tell you that the financially, people are more successful in healthy, good marriages.
I believe that because the communication.
They tend to earn more. There are economies of scale, and you actually produce more with healthy partnerships.
Right.
It's funny because this was in my wedding. So my uncle, who often listens to the show, is our pastor. The minister, or the officiant for our wedding, whatever we want to call it. And he gave this example about oxen. He said, the interesting thing about putting two oxen together in a yoke when they're equally yoked, if you will, is that you don't get twice the output. It's not like one oxen and then put two together, you get two oxen. Two oxen together have the strength of four individual oxen.
Mm.
And that, because there's some mechanical advantages to being able to pull together and to support each other.
Right.
And so that strength advantage happens in healthy, strong relationships.
Right.
I think that happens in partnerships. I think that happens in teams. When the relationships are good, then the output goes up. It's not 1 + 1 = 2. It's 1 + 1 = more than 2.
Right.
Because each person is enhanced by the other person's help.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why those partnerships really matter. But yeah, I think that's a really clever one to bring up on air, man.
Yeah.
Like I said, wasn't the subject of the day, but I think it's one that we all kind of know, but we don't talk about it enough.
Yeah.
Is, you know, the cost of a bad financial relationship and the benefit of a good financial relationship.
Yeah, that's a big one. I think you asked, though, like, you were more specific. You said, like, what's a purchase you wish you had made?
Yeah.
I can remember back, there was a house out on the river when we first got married, and we thought we couldn't afford it. It was, like, $220,000.
Oh, man.
And it was, like, on the North Umpqua. It was gorgeous. And it's, like, in retrospect, we probably could have afforded it, and we didn't do it. And now that house would probably be like a $600,000 to $800,000 home. And it's just like, wow, you know, that one was kind of the one that got away, and you kind of kick yourself for it. But
so, I hear that. Let me give it, that probably a bunch of our listeners are hearing that right now, and you may be thinking too. You mentioned things like Bitcoin. Like, I wish I would have known that when it was really cheap.
Or, yeah.
You know, people said that about Microsoft or Facebook, lots of examples of, I wish I could have got in on the ground floor of something.
Yeah.
I think that's really common, but I remind folks that opportunity is a lot like a river. It's flowing by, and you know, if you don't take this one, something else is going to come by.
Right.
And then something else and something else. So don't pine for the opportunity missed. Because what that will do is keep you from focusing on the next opportunity that shows
up. That's good advice.
And there are just so many, right? The one thing that we have in the United States, and you could say a lot of things, a lot of places, but we still have a fair amount of freedom and a fair amount of opportunity. I'm not going to say it's easy, and I'm not going to say it's risk-free.
Right.
But I am going to say that for the folks that are willing to take those risks, sometimes those risks really pay off.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think we have to take exotically high risk.
No.
Either.
No.
Right? So in this case, it's more like tactically beneficial risk.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So anyway.
Yeah. Sometimes it's hard to find that balancing point because, you know, waiting does feel safe, but sometimes it does have a little bit of a hidden cost to it. And so... Yeah.
What do you think are some of the things that people trip up, though? I mean, I think we wait for all kinds of reasons. And, you know, what do you think a lot of our listeners, I don't want to call them excuses, but the reality is sometimes that's what it is, right? There's these things that we tell ourselves, like, you know what, I'm going to wait until this event. You know, I've got to wait till my kid graduates. I got to wait till I get a raise. I got to wait until the lunar eclipse. I don't know what it is, but like, what are some of the things that you've heard?
I think one of the big ones is, well, another opportunity will just come up, right?
Okay.
Because a lot of people, they think that all opportunity is unlimited, when sometimes it's like the deal was really, really, really good, right? And so, like, sometimes you have to just jump on it, even though it might not be the perfect timing. But it, you know, you also got to weigh that with what you said earlier. A lot of people are like, well, XYZ will catch up And it's like, well, no, you just jumped above your means and you don't have a real actionable plan on how you're going to eventually catch up. And do you have enough of a cushion to kind of buffer that until you get there? And so
I feel like one of the things you're sort of hinting at, let me see if I can
read between those lines.
Yeah. Let me see if I can kind of flesh a little bit more out for our listeners. Some of this sounds like the idea of, like the house you were talking about on the river,
mm-hmm.
where you said, well, I just couldn't afford it, or I couldn't do this, or I couldn't do that. I think, one, there's kind of a screening mechanism that I put things through, like a filter. And the first one is it an asset or a liability?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And that's tricky, right? So am I going to buy something that's going to hold its value or not?
Right.
Then it looks a little bit different.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The other is, I think we do the math a little bit wrong about, am I pricing it in today's dollars or future dollars?
That's a tough one to
do. It's a really tough one because future earnings are hard to predict.
But
the reality is that most of us, if you're listening, there's a good chance you remember a time when minimum wage was well below $10 an hour.
Yep.
And it's not there. It's higher than that.
Right.
Okay? I remember when you could go to fast food restaurants and get items for 50 cents.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That's just not the reality. World we live That's in the anymore. Condiments.
Yeah.
Right. Like, it's just everything costs more because of the way our economy is built, and we've expanded the money supply, which is a cute way of saying we have inflated things. And you can recognize it in minimum wage. Speaking of which, this has held almost everywhere. It worked in Denmark, too. I was looking at the price of things. I don't know if I've ever shared this theory with you. It's kind of random and slightly off subject, but interesting maybe for our listeners. I have a theory on how you can figure out whether or not things are priced according to whether or not people can afford them.
Okay.
It's my fast food value meal theory.
All right.
The theory is pick the most popular value meal on a fast food restaurant's menu.
Mm-hmm.
And it should be roughly the cost of 2/3 of an hour of minimum wage.
Hmm.
And so you look at it and say, okay, well, $12 minimum wage, it's about an $8 meal. If it's $15, it's about a $10 meal. It kind of depends on where you're at in the country and where the minimum wage lands, because it's not the same everywhere.
Sure.
But that's held relatively true everywhere I've been. And the rationale and where I came up with this was the idea that, well, an employee couldn't afford to eat there if it cost more than an hour to buy the meal after paying the government the portion. And so that's just kind of how things start to filter through generically. It's a really terrible proxy for CPI. But but it nevertheless seems to work. And so you can see when fast food restaurants, you know, we had a conversation about this a while ago. Fast food's gotten to where it's not competitively priced. And you're starting to see some pullback and adjustments on those menus because they're not delivering much value. And frankly, you could go to restaurants and sit down and get served for more value than you could get in fast food. And a lot of fast food restaurants aren't even that fast anymore because they're staffed in such a way that they can't deliver on the promise the way maybe they say they could. You know, if it takes 15, 20 minutes for your fast food, I got to tell you, that ain't fast food.
No.
So I think it's fascinating, though, to see that aspect of the economy. Anyway, it's a total sidebar from
what
we're
talking about
today.
It's an interesting thing to think about, though, because, you know, you do look, and a lot of fast food is $10 to $12 anymore.
Yeah.
And so it's like, well, you know.
You see, minimum wage is $15, $16 now.
Yeah. It's starting to make sense why things cost what they do.
Right. But it also explains why starter homes are where they are. But also look at the price of gasoline. Okay. You know, if you're going to spend close to $5 a gallon for gas, which, by the way, looks affordable after going to Europe and paying €2 a liter.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So, like, well, that escalated quickly.
Dang, that's expensive. Yeah.
So, anyway. A lot of electric vehicles there, by the way.
Was there?
And a lot of hybrids. Yeah, we had some kind of, it's hilarious what a seven-seater looks like in Europe.
Is there a lot of Uber buzzing
depending
around?
Where you're at.
Oh, okay.
We used very little Uber. We used it a couple times in Belgium.
How did you guys get around?
So we use public transit a lot. It's a very robust public transit system.
Was it hard to understand since it's in a different language?
Yes, however,
how did
both
you
Google and
that?
Apple they have really good instructions in the mapping programs.
Really?
They actually have a specific segment for public transit that tells you, you know, walk here, look for this specific train number and this thing. Here's the frequency by which it comes, and you're going to go to this station and make this connection.
I don't think I could do Europe. That would stress me out. I would not enjoy myself at all.
It was initially stressful, but if you look at this a little bit more like a challenge or a puzzle to solve, it works better. So listen to you. Now, you'd have been fine. But I understand the aversion. I share in that initial aversion.
Yeah.
But it's so common. And the other alternative is, you know, keep in mind it was a heat wave. So what do you want to do? You want to go walk for 2 miles in 96, 97 degrees? Or would you rather hop on the metro and be there instead of it taking you 40 minutes? It takes you 8 minutes.
Was the metro air conditioned?
No, but at least it's underground.
Oh.
It was hot too. Really? It was just hot there. I mean, it's a heat wave across that whole area. Of course, it's hot here today too. So, anyway, speaking of hot, look at the clock. We're running hot.
Are we? Okay.
Yep. We better take a break. So we'll do that. We will come back, and when we get back, we're going to talk about the concept of leverage in decisions, where the little decisions have big outcomes. So
let's
we want to make sure we get through that. So stick around. We'll be right back. I'm Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
And you got True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
Okay, gang, welcome back to the True Wealth Show. Dave Littlejohn in studio with
Matt Dixon.
Okay, hey, first, I apparently have a correction. Those of you that have been listening to the show today, when I said that when you yoke two oxen together, it produces the output of 4, my uncle is listening and said, I said it was 6. So apparently my memory is mistaken, but nevertheless, even more scale. And so the power of team is great. So again, there's an old joke I remember hearing as a kid. If you want to be financially successful, follow the rule of one, which was, you know, stick with your first house and your first wife, and you can amass wealth. Otherwise, you're going to have to. Now, I suppose for women, it would be your first husband, but you know, I guess that depends on everybody's definitions here. But good decisions, just avoid the bad ones. That helps. But let's talk about these tiny decisions, Matt. You said tiny decisions, but they have big consequences. And framing this in the idea, we're talking about the price of almost.
Would you rather win $50,000 or just make a lot better financial decisions over 25 years?
Well, that one's an easy one for me. Better financial decisions will eclipse a $50,000 win.
But what percentage of Americans do you think would choose the immediate $50,000 gratification?
93%.
Exactly. Yeah, there you go. I think that kind of is the crux of what we're trying to angle at here. It's like,
well, to be fair, it's kind of a false comparison or, you know, false duality there, because if you could win $50,000, you can still make good financial decisions. Right. Like
you could,
because really it's like, well, would you rather win the lottery or not? My answer is I'd like to win the lottery because it's independent of me making good decisions. The problem is if I have to pay to play the lottery, that's not a particularly good decision. So that's the rub, right? If I could play the lottery for free, then I'll play the lottery for free and make good decisions. But that's not how it works.
What are some of those tiny decisions, do you think, that might be ones that really do have huge kind of consequences in the future?
I think the biggest one that comes to the top of my head immediately is the concept of paying yourself first. And so it's this idea of set up a retirement program early and treat it like a bill and fund it. Because compound interest, I was actually watching kind of a presentation on this. There's these sort of three levels to the way compound interest works, and most people struggle to get past level one.
Right, it gets easier almost as you
keep right. Well,
going
the
on.
First level is, hey, I have been putting in contributions for a long time, and I don't even see the growth hardly, right? So your contributions are bigger than the growth, and that's level one. Level two is when it flips and the growth is bigger than the contributions. That's a big deal when you say, like, well, I'm putting $50 a month in. Then how long does it take until it earns more than $50 a month?
Right.
So phase one, you go, well, if I have $10,000 and I make so $50 a month ends up being $600 a year. So at what point can I earn $600 in interest? And if you're making 10%, you need $6,000.
Mm-hmm.
It takes a while at $50 a month to save up to $6,000.
But it gets easier the more.
But then once you do that, the interest is more than $50 a month.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's your contributions. If they start getting bigger, you're putting $500 a month in. Now you can see how, well, now I need to get to $60,000 in order to reach that same threshold.
Mm.
If I'm putting in more, the number just goes up. So that's the first one. What's the next level is when the growth is bigger than your salary.
Mm.
Right, and you realize I have a nest egg capable of replacing my income.
That's
and
a wild
so,
concept.
So there's three chunks to it. The first one is I'm not my contributions are more than the growth. The mm-hmm. next level is the growth is more than the contributions. The last level is my growth is more than my income.
I wonder what that would be as like a ratio of like whatever you make to whatever you have to have to where it basically starts to replace it. Is there like a widely accepted figure on that?
There's not. Because it depends on your rate of return. You know, we've kind of shorthanded the 4% as a rate of return, which is basically take the number times 25.
Yeah.
And if you know, but the reality
is,
I'm
like, on a normal kind of rate of return, you'd have to have about what 20 times your annual.
It's 20 to 25 times. You know, between 4% and 5%,
right.
And then you need at 5%, you need 20 times your
annual
the nest egg,
yeah,
right.
So
if I want $100,000 of income, then I need
$2 million.
I need $2 million earning 5%,
right?
And that, you know, that math is that's where it's just math.
You know, okay? That maybe that's where you start hearing everyone saying, "Hey, you need about, you know, you've seen the articles. Oh, you need mm-hmm. $1 million or you need $2 million to retire." And it's like, well, if you never want to run out of money and you want between $50,000 and $100,000 a year. Less Social Security, all the other things.
Well, and that's
things.
The thing, right? Back out your pension sources.
Right.
And then you also have
just
to factor, am I
investments.
Trying to
yeah.
just live off of the
interest
earnings?
Alone and give it to...
Yeah, know. Or am I going to allow that nest egg to shrink? And so that's, I've said mm-hmm. there's altitude hold versus the melting ice cube.
Right.
Right? Do I want this thing to, the nest egg to never shrink and I just live off the earnings?
A lot of people don't think about that before they come in and start going down the planning route.
Yeah.
They're
yeah.
just like, I've seen so many people just pick an arbitrary number and they're like, I just want to have this much in the account and then I'll feel good.
There's that arbitrary one. Uh-huh. The other one is, what's the definition of retirement? Because I have people who are like, well, I'm retired. It's like, well, you're still at work. So retirement to them is I'm collecting Social Security. Like,
yeah.
That's what retirement means.
Yeah, some people don't want to quit working.
It's like the Princess Bride. You keep using this word. I don't think it means what you think it means. I'm like, what's your definition of retirement here?
Right.
So if it's just,
what is your definition of retirement? I don't know that I actually know the answer.
My
to this.
Definition is you work because you want to, not because you have to.
Okay.
So if you have enough money and the ability to replace your income in such a way that you can sustain your lifestyle without working.
Sure.
Then work is optional.
Mm-hmm.
And the easiest way to affect that is to cap your spending requirement.
Mm-hmm.
Right? The expression is if you want to feel rich, require less. And so if you can live off of $30,000, $40,000, this, by the way, was the FIRE movement, if you remember,
yeah.
financial
yeah.
independence, retire early. It was all like, well,
the van life movement.
There was some of that too, right? Mm-hmm. Like, well, if I can get it to where I only need $1,200 a month to live, I can retire on a pretty small
nest
egg. That
is a very popular trend right now.
Well, it certainly was. I don't know if it still is.
I think it's gaining traction.
Oh, I had heard the alternative, but you know, I'm older. I don't get the same data
yeah.
feeds.
Yeah.
You know, the van life thing, I think, sounds sort of free and vagabond-esque mm-hmm. at first. And so it's like, let's just be gypsies. But as you get older, it's less attractive to not have storage.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, I don't want stuff. It's like, well, it's not about stuff. It's like, I'd like to have seasonal capacity.
Yeah.
Right? I'd like to be able to put a coat somewhere and not have to figure out where to put it in the winter.
Okay, let's take van out of it. I'll ask you a question. What if it was like a $500,000 diesel pusher, super decked out, it's got the laundry capabilities, and you know, you're able to move around, but you're not really tied to anything. No more mowing the lawn, no more dealing with painting the house. Like, does that start to get interesting, or are you like, no, that type of lifestyle?
Well, for some people, I'm sure it does.
Right.
It doesn't really for me. I will admit to, I think there's a certain segment of Gen X, which is squarely where I land.
Yeah.
And this segment sort of saw and was promised the McMansion lifestyle.
Okay.
And that was sort of internalized.
Right.
I really enjoy getting outside, and like, I still like camping and rolling in the dirt and backpacking and being super minimalist.
Mm-hmm.
But for me, that's a retreat to go do that and just have, it's a test against skill and sort of reduction. You know, so that you're not so tied to the stuff, because I think stuff really can become a distraction, and it can also, it starts to own you. So I like to have that separation from stuff.
You know what's
crazy? But I do like space. I really do.
I feel like this attraction to stuff is a relatively newer concept, right? Because you go, I feel like, and granted, I didn't live through this era, so maybe I'm way off base, but you look at photos of the 1940s and 50s, and you just go back in time. People were in, you know, 800 square foot homes with, if they were lucky, a one car garage. The family had one car. No one had storage units, weren't really a thing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if you had a boat or something, it's like, wow, you're upper middle class, maybe.
Yeah,
and people just like, they went to work and they hung out with their family, and that was good enough. And then you move into the next 50 to 60 years or 70 years, and then we get this huge attraction to things, and now you've got to have a three-car garage, and it's got to be full, and you've got to have this toy, and you got to have that toy. So we've materialized everything. And just looking at history and the way that things swing, I actually think that you might start to see a swing back to a more minimalist lifestyle.
Well, here would be my counterpoint to that.
Okay.
I actually think that would be kind of healthy.
Sure.
It'd be healthy if we got a little less materialistic and a little less tied to our screens.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't disagree with you in concept here. The counterpoint is more about, yeah, but what about this? Okay. My theory,
theory.
I do.
Spit it out.
Well, no, I'm gonna do the worst thing possible. We have one more segment. I'm looking at the clock.
I'll throw a pin at you. Spit it out.
If we take the break now, I can use this as a cliffhanger.
All right.
You want to hear my theory about the idea of whether the trend is to go back towards a more simple and less materialistic or not? Whether or not, well, I'll share my theory on what's impacting that when we come back.
Okay.
I'm Dave Littlejohn.
And Matt Dixon.
And you got True Wealth on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
This is KQEN Local Talk at 4 on News Radio 93.9 FM and 1240 KQEN.
Hey, King, welcome back to the home stretch of the
True
Wealth
Show. Where
I'm
giving Dave lovely life advice.
Yeah. So, by the way, we talk about small decisions. This is one of them that everybody can cringe a little bit. We now joke because I have a Cadillac Escalade from 2010 that has
super low miles,
almost 238,000 miles on it. And little things are starting to go wrong, and I'm having to make the decision of, do I fix this thing because it is paid for, or is it a time bomb in which
I
fix it and then it breaks again anyway?
David,
and
you're
I have
playing
to give
the
up.
Wrong game here. So what you do is you just don't fix the things and see how long it keeps rolling down the road on just a massive amount of deferred maintenance. Oh, you need a new tie rod? That's a suggestion. Let's see if the wheel actually falls off.
My rule is it can't become unsafe. The thing does burn a healthy amount of oil now, so the oil is changed every 3,000 miles pretty religiously, and it's always replaced.
I live less than a mile from work, so I can get away with it. They told me, they're like, oh, your suspension shot on this old truck. And I said, you know what? That's fine, but we're going to just play an experiment.
Yeah.
That Ford will hold together. You watch. You
probably will. Well, when you're putting 8 miles a year on it,
right?
You're right.
Exactly. I'm like, no, we're going to keep driving this thing.
Like Matt's on the original tank of gas still.
Dude, there was a time where I think it was one tank of gas a year with that thing.
Oh, man.
I need to get the specialty plates where you don't have to pay registration anymore.
All right. Let me share, because everybody that was on the break is wondering, what's this theory that Dave has?
Yes.
Your theory, Matt, or maybe it's not your theory, but you suggested.
Yeah, what if we swing the other way? And
that maybe people are moving away from materialism, mm-hmm. and kind of downsizing, and they're sort of rejecting some of that culture.
Right.
And I do think that there is, particularly in young people, there's some of that going on, and it's almost fashionable because things have gotten so ridiculously expensive that this is a little bit of a way to, rebel
buck
against
the trend.
System.
Yeah, exactly.
But here's my counterpoint to it. My counter theory, if you will.
We actually argued this on the radio while you were gone. So I've
really?
You give me your point and I'll give you another one.
My
to think
theory
about.
Is that we were taught to be materialistic. That's what advertising does.
Mm-hmm.
That the nature of advertising marketing is to incentivize a need or a feeling of need.
Right.
There are many things that we don't truly need at all, but we have been sort of coached and baited into wanting these things and feeling like life is incomplete without them. It starts at a very young age. We're getting less television commercials than we used to, but now we're getting direct advertising on the internet. And everybody's on a screen, and so we're constantly being bombarded with these micro messages that your life is incomplete without this thing if you don't look this way or mm-hmm. that way. And so I think that we have extraordinarily sophisticated big data driven marketing that creates, even for folks that think that they don't have a need or a want for stuff,
yeah.
it niches into their life in such a way that it finds the areas where they are sort of weak and then just leans there. So it's less of a broad scale perhaps, but it's still all about trying to extract wallet share from the people that are being advertised to. And we're not taught that. We are just bombarded with it. You just see the amount of screen time that people put into their phones and all of that subtle advertising. And we all hear like, oh, the phone's listening to you. I had a conversation about bananas, and before I knew it, I was getting advertisements for bananas. Hmm. You know, it's like, I think it's that sophisticated. And it's really hard to resist that.
Yeah. I think marketing, like you said, is getting way, way better. I think that one of the things I've noticed is just people are starting to delete Facebook accounts. They're starting to go with less screen time. Like, I know
I haven't observed that.
I feel like it's kind of peaked. And I just know, like, I know a lot of people personally that have, like, started to ditch TV subscriptions. And they've deleted stuff off and they're just, like, they're overwhelmed. I think millennials kind of got overwhelmed by everything.
Well, maybe it's the age of millennials. Like, because if I had to guess, let me see if this is accurate.
Yeah.
Do you think that is mostly millennials that are starting young families?
Yeah, I think it's that, and even generations younger than us. Because I've heard so many people admit to it, where it's like they're mid-20s, and they're like, I feel like screen time ruined me. Like the iPad ruined me. And they're self-aware to it. They're starting to get self-aware to it. And when those people start having kids, I think they're just going to go the other way, where it's like, nah, we're just going to drop out of this material culture. Because millennials aren't buying diamonds and gold, right? Like our grandparents did, our parents
did.
Or
alcohol. That's another
interesting
thing.
Yeah, or alcohol. Yeah. And so it's like this reversion back to like, oh, well, I just want to have a little garden and raise the kids out in the dirt. And it's like, if that catches on and continues to move that way. And the other part of it is, I think people are maxed out. Like, I think credit cards got maxed out. And as people learn that hard lesson, I actually think some people might really learn from it and not do it again. Where it's like, you know what? We're just going to start to live below our means, and we're not going to be materialistic. We'll go do experiences. We'll go to Disneyland, or we'll go do this. But we're not going to have a bunch of cool toys.
Yeah. I'll tell you one thing that has kind of showed up in my brain. I met a guy at the airport, and we were flying from Denmark to Brussels.
Okay.
And when we were, I should have said Belgium, right? But whatever. But this guy was actually from Spain, and he was working in Denmark. And we just started up a conversation.
Mm-hmm.
But he lives on the beach in Spain, and he was a high-end welder. like okay. very, very talented, like aerospace welding and specialty materials and so forth. But his job, he would work in Denmark for 3 weeks and then go back to Spain for 2 weeks. And he just did that back and forth.
Nice.
So he did a lot of travel. And he said he has a motorcycle. And when he needs a truck or something, he just goes and rents it for the time that he needs it. Or if he's going to take his family on a trip or something, yeah. he just goes and rents the vehicle, uses it, and then gives it back. And I thought, that's actually quite brilliant. Mm-hmm. Because there's this thinking for I've struggled with, which is, well, why rent it if I could just buy it and I could have it? Yeah, but now you have it.
And
you
have now
to put
you have
it
the
somewhere.
Responsibility
and,
of it, yeah.
you know, eventually you have to maintain it or dispose of it. If you just use it for the period of time that you're using it and move on, it's a little bit more of a consumer tilt, but it's less of an attachment to stuff.
Yeah.
And I thought that was an interesting take.
Yeah. If you could only keep three material things in your life, what would they be? Three. Not family, none of that stuff. Just like, is there? Can you name three things that you just would not part ways with?
Well, I'd like a home. I mean, are we still retiring that level?
No. Yeah, no.
Or you're just talking about things that you're, like a thing that you want?
Yeah, like a thing that you have. Like, so for me, I inherited my grandpa's lever action 30-30. I wouldn't part with that thing. That would be one of the three things I would keep. Not getting rid of that.
One of them
awesome.
That I would keep is Miss Nellie Bell. That's the...
I don't know this.
This is the Camaro that I have.
Oh, okay.
So I have a 68 Camaro convertible that was my grandfather's. Mm-hmm. He bought it brand new off the showroom. And then he... Or at least that's my understanding. And it's been in the family ever since. And like my cousins have had it and everything. But it's landed in my care. And that is literally something that is instructed that it needs to stay titled in the Little John name and be passed on as an heirloom. And it's just not for sale. I've had pretty big offers for it before. And I'm just, I don't want to sell it. Like I don't care to sell it. I'm nostalgically attached to it and want it to be an heirloom.
Mm-hmm.
Doesn't make sense, but that's probably
the
only thing
I really
could think of.
That makes sense. Yeah. Is there much past the Camaro?
No.
See what I'm saying? Like, when it really comes down to it, I can only think of one or two things that I'm, like, super, super attached to, and the rest of it's like, I could be convinced to get rid of it, but our nature is to hold on to the stuff, which is kind of wild.
It's true. I have stuff that I'm like, that should be let go of.
Mm-hmm.
I'm reaching an age where I'm starting to view it more.
There you go.
Look, we got a few minutes left. Not even minutes. We've got seconds left. Let's keep it real simple. If you are looking for financial advice or help from folks that are pretty grounded and down to earth and want to help you, that, you know, if you don't have somebody, give us a shout. How do they reach us, Matt?
Yeah, Little John Financial. Call us at 541-375-0898 or go to the website at littlejohnfs.com.
All right. Catch you next week. Thanks, everyone.